Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to one of the most revered comic book creators of all time, Chris Claremont, the man whose historic 17-year run as writer of the Uncanny X-Men influenced the style and tone of all of the blockbuster movies that followed, including the upcoming Days of Future Past. We'll talk about that, of course, but he's mostly here to discuss Murata, the She-Wolf, the sword and sorcery series that he and illustrator John Bolton created in the 1980s. It's just been collected in a single, beautiful volume by Titan Books. Stick around. Claremont may be older, but he's just as handy with a blade and as quick with an incantation as ever. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience that includes Halle Berry, Hugh Jackman, Jennifer Lawrence, Anna Paquin, Michael Fassbender and Ian McKellen, and James McAvoy and Patrick Stewart, in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Marvel Comics' epic era slipped by me while I was in college and starting my career. That's my only explanation for how a guy who read all of the Conan the Barbarian, Kull the Conqueror, and even Grew the Warrior and Ironjaw comics missed seeing Chris Claremont and John Bolton's work the first time on Murata the She-Wolf. Fortunately, those pages have finally been collected in a single stunning hardcover graphic novel by Titan Books, and reading it is a sheer pleasure. Murata is a sword and sorcery warrior woman of the First Order. No doubt the silver-haired beauty would give Red Sonja a battle that fanboys would pay to see. And a movie? You betcha. As for Claremont, you're bound to be familiar with his work, or at least his influence, if you've ever picked up a comic book or watched a superhero movie. Shortly after artist Dave Cockrum and writer Len Wein rejuvenated a dying Marvel Comics series in giant-sized X-Men, Claremont joined Cockrum for an extraordinary run on the monthly Uncanny X-Men comic, beginning with issue number 94. Now, when Cockrum moved on about a year later and John Byrne stepped in, Claremont provided continuity that lasted almost two decades. And in 1991, when Marvel launched a second X title, simply known as X-Men, the first issue sold more than 8 million copies, a record that stands to this day and can be found in the Guinness Book of World Records. And while he isn't officially credited, or credited enough, I should say, it is Claremont's X-Men who have filled the silver screen from 2000's X-Men title through a series of Wolverine films and finally X-Men Days of Future Past. It is truly, and I mean truly, a thrill and an honor for someone whose very first comic book purchase, X-Men number 20, was made by his grandfather at a New York Port Authority newsstand in 1966 to welcome today's guest. Chris Claremont, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
It's great to have you here. I gotta ask, I threw aside the wrong piece of paper. Good start, right?
So you were in sync for a moment.
That's funny. So Chris, I realize that I'm not the only comics fan who might have missed Murata the She-Wolf, but it's a great piece of work, and I wondered how the revival of Murata came about.
Basically, Titan wanted to give it a shot. There's always been a serious admiration for John's work over in the UK, and aside from a couple of recycled version iterations of it from Marvel, the totality of the series hasn't been reprinted in better than 30 years.
Wow.
So they figured, let's give it a shot and see what happens. And my feeling always was that if the reprint, the first volume, is successful, then that might prove a sufficient justification to get John interested in doing the next story in the saga.
Well, and it's definitely on my list of things I want to ask you about. Do you want to continue this character in this story?
Oh, I always want to continue, whether it's Murata or Sovereign Seven or the X-Men. That's the nature of how I tend to write stories. But in terms of Murata, if you want to look at the whole arc, the first chapter gets her and Arianrod thrown across the world magically. The end of the first story, Arianrod says, "I could try and cast a spell to magic us home," and Murata says, "Maybe not." We end up in demon, surrounded by demons. In that case, why don't we just walk home? It'll take longer, but I'm getting into. And the second story was in mid East Africa, Meroe, the kingdom of Meroe, mm-hmm. Black Kingdom of Meroe, I should say. The third story was, I guess you could call it, an Arabian Nights tale that occurred after they set sail from Alexandria towards Rome. The next chapter would, if it comes to pass as I envisioned it, would have Murata showing up in Rome midway through the reign of Augustus Caesar, which, all things considered, is a remarkably interesting time because Caesar has not yet... Well, he's in the process of solidifying his realm. Rome is getting used to having an imperial structure as opposed to a republican senatorial-based structure. But from the perspective of the characters... Here comes this warrior woman who, oh yes, the only surviving direct descendant, i.e. granddaughter, of Julius Caesar. Not a good position to be in Rome, because that instantly makes her an object of desire for everybody, as was established in the first scene of the first story. That's why she was grabbed by the tribune, and who he wanted to sacrifice to, who demon gods wanted her as a sacrifice. He tried to smuggle her back to Rome. He paid the price. In this instance, Murata would come into full contact with Caesar's family, with the political forces in Rome, with Caesar's wife, who had her own ambitions to bring Tiberius in as heir. And fun would be had by all. And there would, of course, be a spectacular scene in the gladiatorial arena. But that's just me fantasizing off the top of my head. How we could, you know... The problem with that is that we need the artist, and John hasn't let us know one way or the other if he's intrigued enough to give it a shot. So, fingers crossed. Hope with the new year, there's new hope.
Chris, when you write a contemporary comic like an X-Men, you probably try not to tie events too closely to actual things that are happening. But when you do something like Murata, it's interesting to have you talk about the Julius Caesar and Rome. Because it's past history and what happened is clearly established, you can go in different ways with it. Have you done a series before that connected to actual history as closely as you're attempting here?
Well, I mean, the Black Dragon was very much tied in with 10th, 11th century England. Okay. Yeah, it's the nature of historical adventure fantasy is to blend the two together in a way that looks seamless. I mean, the point with Rome in the last half century BC, the first half century AD, is you look on it as a society in turmoil. In terms of what's happening with Rome, you have the establishment of the imperial state. So it's an upheaval, a political upheaval of the first order. They've just gone through the better part of a generation of intestine warfare between the so-called Republicans and the imperialists, at Mark Antony and Octavian, and then the subsequent conflict between Octavian and Mark Antony. Mm. So there's a whole lot of tumult there. If you were to move ahead to, let's say, the 6th century AD, you think, well, it's the Dark Ages. What can you do there? Well, if you look around the world, one of the last major westward expansions of the Chinese Empire. Mm-hmm. In the generation before the rise of Islam. So then you can start to think, well, let's see, 6th century, the age of Arthur, reportedly the age of Arthur, but what would happen if somehow Muhammad got deflected, that Islam did not suddenly become the bellmark political force of the mid-first millennia? How would that change? What if China got in the way? Hmm. How would that change the subsequent history of, I guess, megacontinental Eurasia? Hmm. Another fantasy I played with was, what if back in the day there was no divine wind, that when China invaded Japan, they succeeded? What happened to the samurai? Well, most of them died, but let's hypothesize. A few thousand of them escaped over the Pacific, sailing eastward until they got to California. Well, how would the Indians, especially the Plains Indians, react to an incursion of samurai warriors, Japanese samurai warriors, on horseback? And then what would happen 400 years after that when the Spaniards arrived? And instead of finding Indians, they found an integrated Indian-Japanese culture with a measure of technology, with horses already in place. Suddenly, America is not the virgin, lightly resistant air. Battleground that it became. You know, it's the what if that a writer uses, especially when you're dealing with historical fantasy, is as vast as the imagination. It's just a matter of pulling the pieces together in ways that are accurate and relevant to the historiology of the place, of the time, but also relevant in the story that's being told to the readers of today. So you create characters who you or I or whoever is relating, able to relate to as a reader, but in a context that is an incredible lot of fun to visualize.
It sounds like a cross between History of the World and Marvel's What If, when you describe it.
But that's the essence of writing fiction.
Yeah. No, I mean, it sounds very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to come back to something you said. Actually, you mentioned twice, and I didn't quite take the bait earlier, but in Joe Duffy's foreword to the hardcover Murata, she mentions how you came to her all excited that you and John were going to get to do something, and she couldn't tell you at the time that she didn't know who John was. So I wanted to know, how did you become familiar with John Bolton? How did he cross your path, and what's the holdup to getting him back on board now?
Well, how I got introduced to him is simple. He was actually the person who found him, as it were, was Ralph Macchio.
Oh.
Who I hired during my last days back in the dawn of time as associate editor of Marvel Comics. Back then I was Len Wein's and then Marv Wolfman's number two guy. Whoopee! But I decided I'd had enough and was going freelance. Unfortunately, Marv hadn't told me he was doing the same thing. Otherwise, I would have stuck around and maybe I could have become editor-in-chief. Totally different wish fulfillment there. Any road. Ralph had seen John's work, I believe, for Marvel UK and other comic publications over in London, and wanted to get a hold of him to do stuff over at for Marvel. So the first gig he had for Marvel was Red Skull. No, a Conan? Might have been a Conan. A Cull. Sorry, Cull.
All right.
And it was beautiful. Spectacular. So the pitch to me was, do you want to work with John? I said, hell yes. I sat down with John. We came up with a concept, which was Murata, which originally started out, well, which became Murata. Originally, it was Red Sonja.
Aha. Uh-huh. So there is a bit of a connection there in birds.
Oh, yeah. We weren't thinking of doing original because there was no epic at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So we started working on it, and then as I was getting deeper into the plot and John was starting to pencil, Marvel lost all the licenses. So suddenly we had 20 dead pages and a really good story, and both of us were really pissed and wanted to figure out how could we do this. And then we thought about it, and the idea popped into one or both of our heads simultaneously, and basically, well, why don't we pitch it as our own concept? I mean, nothing's been established. There's nothing we can't change. Mm-hmm. The story doesn't exist yet as a completed entity. So we changed the one flat, because the operational structure of the story was, we were going to take the central character out of her comfort zone. In other words, ditch the steel bikini, have her dress sensibly, and do a historical fantasy. Well, why not just ditch the bikini, change the names, and do a historical fantasy? And, you know, of course, shocked expressions of disbelief. Why didn't we think of that? And then, to our intense surprise, not only did Archie Goodwin think that was the best idea he'd heard since sliced bread, simply because it was a brilliant, you know, John's work was just too brilliant to resist. Jim Shooter was totally on board with it as editor-in-chief, and was actually instrumental in helping us facilitate the transition from wholly owned work for hire to wholly creator-owned. And it was great.
Is the story true that's in the book that Shooter's mother named the character?
She came up with a name, and we used it. Yeah.
And is the name – it only occurred to me as we've been talking, Murata sounds a little like Marauder. Is there any connection there?
Probably.
Okay.
The problem with names is that once you get past Dr. Doom
– yeah.
All the great names are taken. I mean, Stan and Jack and Steve, between the three of them, pretty much chewed up all the primo names in the source book. You know, I was lucky enough to grab a few, like Phoenix, but it's been hard. You know, you can't really argue with a guy named Dr. Doom.
Yeah. Yeah, very few people have survived having that argument.
But that's the essence of a great superhero villain.
Has it been tough to know you guys created this character all these years and to see her on the sidelines, especially as so many characters have gone to film and, you know, the rights have been picked up for things?
We were ahead of the curve. There was no, you know, we had an offer back in the day. Someone wanted the film rights. He was willing to pay like $50. And it wasn't, you know, we decided not to.
Is there any film connection or rights connection in terms of bringing the character back to print now?
No.
Okay.
The interesting paradox is that while it is not unusual to have women as the central character in TV series, especially action adventure TV series, it's virtually non-existent in cinema. It's a weird thing. It's like everyone loves Sigourney Weaver as Ripley, but it seems very hard to get a film company to bankroll a big budget 8-9 figure production with her as the centerpiece. I don't mean necessarily Sigourney Weaver by herself, but Ripley as the centerpiece. You will see James Bond up, down, and sideways. You will not see Modesty Blaise, who's as a character in a novel is equally as much fun. Yet the 1.5 films that were attempted about the character were at best disasters, and at worst, I mean, it's a weird thing. Studios do not seem willing to support a concept that is grounded in a woman at the center. Mm-hmm. So
now,
when you're shopping a concept that a prose concept or a comic, an art concept that is defined around a woman, you know, Xena, you can get away with Xena on FX, I guess, but you can't do it in the movies.
Now, that said, I'm going to take issue with one thing. Because as I read this, I was thinking of two women who could carry this in a film if they were inclined and have proven that they could carry an action character, and that would be either Angelina Jolie or Jennifer Lawrence these days. Either one of them could probably.
No, this isn't meant.
No, but I mean,
it's a criticism of the actresses.
No, it's the studio's willingness to jump on and invest the money. I understand that. Yeah,
I mean I don't know, and I don't know whether it's the fact that they're looking at it from the point of view of we're going to shell out a 9-figure budget. We have to have a guarantee that it's going to recoup at the end. I just don't know. Mm. You know, if I did know, I'd be on the left coast producing this stuff and being a multi-gazillionaire, but I'm not. So all I can do is speculate from the far outside looking over the fence.
Well,
the fence.
All I'll say about that is this. If I was a studio head right now and I saw the hardcover of Murata, the She-Wolf, mm-hmm. and I had seen the success that Jennifer Lawrence had had in just about everything she embodied, I would buy it and try to get her. I would buy the rights and try to get her to sign on. She would look the part to me. I think she would carry it very well. Maybe a little young at this point, but by the time these things happen.
The other question is that gets you the first step, which is making the film. The second step is, can you get the audience in the door? Mm. There was an impassioned diatribe on Bleeding Cool, I think, the other day from Paul Dini, where he was aghast because producers, networks, would not buy concepts, would not buy series, TV series, animated series, that were built around a female, either a female lead or a superhero team with a significant number of female characters in it. Hmm. Male characters, they felt, male audiences watch our shows. Girls don't. Boys will buy our toys. Girls want dolls. I don't think that's right, because let's face it, of those 17 years of the X-Men, for most of those years, we had better than 100 to 150,000 women an issue buying the book. And when you consider that was 40 or 50% of a 300,000-400,000 print run, which was not fictitious printing, that was actual sales. Mm-hmm. That said quite a lot. I think the fact that that Uncanny back in those days spoke as rationally and eloquently as I could do, as I could produce it, to both men and women in the audience, boys and girls, brought them all into the audience fold and left them eager, satisfied and eager for more. Mm. And if we could do it there, why can't we do it outside of the book on screen? To my mind, that was a no-brainer. But obviously, my perception as a creator is not the same as a studio executive's as the studio. And you can see it even now with the number of series that are still male-centric with one or two stock women in the cast, but not primary.
Chris, let me extend this conversation of women a little bit in a way that I wouldn't have, but for the accident that we had some extra time due to technical issues before we started, and you were telling me a little bit about your mother, and mm-hmm. People have written before and talked about your ability, your penchant for writing good women's roles in comics and other things. Your mother, I think you said your mother was with the RAF, the mm-hmm. British. She was a pilot.
As was my father, as was my uncle.
Okay. I'm thinking in terms of having a strong mother, who I'm assuming to be a strong mother, a strong personality, perhaps, just a strong woman. Do you think that gives you, gave you over the course of your career, gives you a different perspective on how women can be portrayed in general, whether in fiction or real life, that maybe other people don't have that experience of?
I don't know if it could be called a different perspective. It is my perspective. It comes under the heading of write what you know. And in my life, I have known an extraordinary number of incredibly intelligent, incredibly brave men and women. I have one very good friend who, aside from being a multi, aside from multiple nominations and one win of the Pulitzer Prize, has on numerous occasions gone herring off into the backcountry of Zaire looking for the latest iteration of Ebola to research it and report on it. My best friend, I worked in radio, works in radio, and one morning I'm listening to Morning Edition, Saturday Morning Edition on NPR, and the reporter is broadcasting from Sarajevo. And the next thing I know, I hear my friend Manoli announcing, telling him to duck his head, they're shooting at us. Oh, and you hear the bullets going by. Really, really close. It's a good microphone. And I, trust me, there's nothing more guaranteed to wake you up more quickly and more terrifyingly than hearing someone you know being shot at. And thanking goodness it wasn't live radio. Figure it's a tape, they've got to be okay. But it's, you know, the fact, it's not that my friend was any more or less brave than, you know, that Manoli was any more or less brave than Scott Simon, who was doing the interview. They were both there. They were both taking the risk. They were both doing their job as professionally and eloquently as they knew how. And my response as a writer is, if these people that I know of in real life can do that, then I got to be able to find a way to have the fictional characters that I'm writing behave just as courageously, just as resourcefully, just as stupidly, if you want to look at it that way, and get away with it. The point is, take no one for granted, regardless of gender, regardless of age, regardless of social circumstance. Figure out why they're here, what they want, and do it. And if you treat them honestly, if you treat the situation honestly and ethically, hopefully the audience will respond in kind and with enthusiasm. And knock wood, for quite a while, thank heaven, they've done so. But that's, especially when you're dealing with superheroes, that's the key to, you know, what I think help make the X-Men click, what would make any good action hero click.
Well, it's an issue that I have to be honest, until I had a daughter, I didn't think that much about. You know, you would read about it, but until it hits home with you, and then suddenly I have a daughter, and I look at, like, the superheroes, and I thought, oh, I have to have a little different perspective on this. And so I paid attention to something like this, you know, how women are presented. I made a point of, when she was very young, she had an interest in superheroes. I would go out of my way to find her the action figures that were women instead of, you know, I didn't get her Superman, or I would find, you know, Supergirl or Uhura on Star Trek, things like that. So this, mm-hmm. you know, over time, now she's 17. I think she's a fairly strong young woman. She's going to mm-hmm. go out and I think make movies is probably what she's going to do. And I'm hoping that, you know, she has a strong sense of self and as strong a sense of self as a female as I would hope that I would have brought to a son in the same way. Mm-hmm. So when I talk to someone like yourself who has a very strong reputation for treating women in fiction with respect and equally approach them equally, I just think it's more interesting.
Well, it's on my part, it's purely selfish. I mean, I don't want to write boring characters, so I have to presume, I hope, the audience doesn't want to read them. Hmm. And the trick is, why should a character be any more or less exciting or interesting or compassionate because of their gender? One should have nothing to do with the other. It's an aspect of primal character, and you take it from there.
You've been incredibly gracious about your time, and I very much appreciate that. I want to just ask you a couple of things that are X-Men related, mm-hmm. and then we'll let you get out of here. One of the things that's so noteworthy about your X-Men run was, besides the quality of it, it went on for 17 years just the first time. You came back mm-hmm. a couple times after that for shorter stints. What in the world of comics, where it's very unusual for people to stay 6 months or even a year, you stayed 17 years. Is it that you became so possessive of the title, or how? Why does a man or woman, for that matter, stay on a title that long in comics?
Well, I think three aspects to the question. It was a really good gig, and every issue, it did better than the issue before. I had the extraordinary good fortune to work with a succession of brilliant creators, in not simply in terms of the artists I worked with, but the editors, for a large part, and specifically Archie Goodwin and Louise Simonson and Ann Nesenti. And they were great characters. They were fun. I get asked at conventions, what's my favorite issue? And I have to say the answer is 94 to 279 inclusive, plus the miniseries, plus the spinoffs, plus the annuals. Because to me, it's one story. It has little bits in it. You can cut it up into subsets. But you're looking at the life, for me, the life of these 20 or 30 characters, of these 20 or 30 people. I'm writing a biography, not a set of comic book adventures. And from that perspective, I want to see what happens next. I want to see where they end up. I want to see what questions they answer in their lives. That's why the reason I left the first time basically came down to my perception of the characters as the products of an author, whereas Marvel's perception of them was as tools, as extensions of our corporate sponsorship. And what you had was a desire on the part of editorial to move back towards the traditional vision of how to approach characters and storytelling, which is you recycle every 3 or 4 years so that you bring in a new team and they retell the same old stuff, but with a slightly different perspective, that of the new writer, the new artist, the new editorial regime, the new generation. I wasn't interested in that because to me, these were real people. I wanted to get to a point where Scott and Madeline would leave the team and live happily ever after and raise their children in Alaska, having a normal life, with Scott coming back from time to time for exciting adventures, special adventures, annuals, crossovers, you name it. But it would be, he comes in, he has an adventure, he moves out. It's why when X Factor came about, my suggestion was do not bring back Jean, bring in her sister Sarah, leave Scott and Madeline alone, let Scott run the team, keep the same parameter, have him do it from the perspective of I have a wife and son now. I have a life. I have to balance these two. And Madeline has to deal with, oh my God, Scott's risking his life for these idiots. Where do I fit into this? But more importantly, Jean's sister would open the playing field to Bobby and Warren and Hank. If you bring back Jean, you're just recreating the original, and Scott and Jean are off the table, and the other three are left twiddling their thumbs wondering what's going to happen with our lives. That to me is boring. Mm. So the point in all of this is to find a way to evolve things, to open things up. And again, the reason you take Scott off the board is you open the team for Aurora to take over as leader of the team. Mm-hmm. And she didn't have any power, so it was even more cool. And maybe at some point she moves on and someone else comes in. So my paradigm was, you pick up the book at issue 100, you see one iteration. You come back for issue 300, you'll see a different one. There will be similar characters. And some of the same characters will still be there, but there'll be whole new guys, gals, a mix. If you come back for issue 500, even more so, so that you redefine the team, the mix of characters for each reading generation. So that, wow, my dad read this book and that was one group of characters. I'm reading this book and it's another group of characters that I love. Mm-hmm. And my kid will read this book and he'll have, or she'll have, an even more extremely difficult contemporary, different and contemporary blend of characters. That's as it should be. There should be a growth and an evolution. You shouldn't lock yourself in to the same pattern being done over and over and over again, because that ultimately gets boring. Mm-hmm. And you run the risk then of a reader who's been around for 3 or 4 years looking at it and saying, wait, but if you do this with character Z, you've invalidated the continuity that existed 5 years ago. You've made him an asshole. Again, as happened with Scott. You know, he walked out on his wife and baby for his old girlfriend. Mm-hmm. It took years, more than a few years, to even begin to recover from that catastrophe. I mean, we'd like to think we did, but it would have been so much better if we'd never had it, the catastrophe in the first place. That's the challenge in a long-running comic series. But if you're switching creators every 2 years, every 25 issues, every 3 years, 4 years, it's a reboot. So nobody notices, nobody really cares. The new readers might, or the old readers might, the new readers, who's going to notice? Mm. Which is another reason why, from a company perspective, it's a more practical way of managing things, because you can go for the bright, shiny, creative object of the month. You can get a Joss Whedon. You can get a Brian Bendis. You can get whomever is really, really cool this year to do the book, instead of finding yourself locked in with someone who, for all anyone knows, might be the second incarnation of Stan. But even after a while, you want to, well, that's great, but I've been eating the same meal for 20 years. Why don't we order sushi tonight and see what happens? It's, you know, as a creator, I think they screwed up. But as a corporate, you know, at the time, you know, having been a corporate executive, I can understand why they do it, why they feel the need to do it. And the trick is finding a balance between the two.
Well, speaking of that, I think this is a good place to ask, what, if anything, is Chris Claremont's relationship to the long line of films that have appeared based on the X-Men? And I said at the top that, you know, I think a lot of people feel, I think it's true, that these movies have been largely inspired by your long run and your influence over the years.
Well, okay. Here's a secret backstory.
Okay.
Way back in the day, this would be 97, I guess. Lauren Shuler Donner met with us, with Marvel, me and Bob Harris, among others. And they wanted to, Fox wanted to do X-Men movies. She was going to produce it. We met here in New York where she was filming You've Got Mail. Bryan Singer was in on the meeting because he was who she wanted to direct it. And we talked about it. And it was a great, great discussion. And afterwards, they went back and started trying to pull it all together. And they couldn't get a script. It didn't feel right. And the concept was approaching turnaround. In retrospect, we should have left it alone. It should have gone into turnaround. It should have reverted. Marvel should have regained control, and Kevin should have been producing that at the helm of the Avengers. But what happened was I wrote a memo. 6-7 pages, single-spaced, basically breaking down the concept into characters and situations and saying, in cinematic terms, in audience terms, this is what it's all about. It's not superheroes. It is racial oppression, gender oppression. There's a reason why the X-Men, my X-Men at least, have always spoken, it seems, most eloquently to black audiences, to gay audiences, to Mormon audiences, to people who perceive themselves as being on the outside looking in. And that's what you have to capture in the movie. And the next thing I knew, I get a call from Lauren saying it worked. Next thing I know, I get a call and a letter from the production head of production at Fox saying, you did it. You got us going. And that got the whole thing off the ground. So I like to think of it in my own egocentric sort of way as it's all my fault. That said, you can go through all 7 films from the get-go, and my conceptual fingerprints are all over it. I mean, the characters, the conflicts, the lines, especially in the second movie, where, you know, they basically took pieces of God Loves, Man Kills, of Dark Phoenix, and brought them all to life. X-Men 3 should have been Dark Phoenix. The problem was Hollywood Adventures got in the way. you know, with directors going off and shooting Superman instead of X-Men and deciding they didn't want to do this and quitting and unchangeable release dates. On the other hand, in Wolverine 1, when Hugh Jackman looks at Silvercloud and says, "I'm the best there is at what I do, but what I do best isn't very nice." I'm sorry, that's my signature line. You know, I was cheering in the audience. My wife was elbowing me as hard as she could to shut me up. The point, I guess, is that my conceptual fingerprints are all over the seven films, one way or another. My characters, my characterizations are all over it. But by the same token, the other thing that is most eloquent in this is the casting brilliance of Lauren Shuler Donner and her team and Brian and his team. I mean, she brought Hugh Jackman into the mix when Doug Ray Scott got injured. And as Jackman himself has said, that made his career. That took him from being a London, an Olivier-winning London stage actor to an international cinema star. Not such a sad thing. It got me the treat of watching Ian McKellen, who, when I was a young actor, back in the dawn of time, I would go watch on Broadway to learn my craft. Well, now he's doing my lines in my conception of Magneto. I'm not going to, you know, I get to see actors that I admire, that I respect, that I think are the coolest things since sliced bread, doing the characters that I created, that I shaped, doing lines that I've written. You know, in Days of Future Past, it's my story. Regardless of how it may evolve between now and May when it comes out, it started with John's and my 34 pages, two parts comic issues, in the same way that the Wolverine started as Frank's and my miniseries. I mean, they may have pulled in bits and pieces from Larry's Wolverine and whomever, but at its foundation, it's Frank's and my story.
So clearly, Chris, you're proud of the movies, you're excited to see them. Did the productions take better care of you than, say, Gary Friedrich got off of Ghost Rider, for example? Have you been compensated in some way for what's come from your mind?
This is a trick question, right?
No, it's just a question.
Compensated? The compensation is sitting in the audience and saying, "Wow, that's cool."
Okay.
I mean, the compensation in a way was, I guess, was Hugh Jackman getting up at the premiere for Wolverine and introducing Len and saying, "This is the guy who brought my character to life. Gave me the opportunity, created the character that gave me the opportunity to be who I and what I am today." That is cool. Everything else, I mean, the problem with X-Men is that if this were a Marvel Studios production, that would be a whole different thing. But the X concept is totally owned by Fox. Fox has nothing to do with Marvel. I don't think Fox has any interest at all in Marvel, other than they have to send them whatever pittance they send them every whatever. I think we have the respect of the creators involved. Certainly I know that with Lauren and with Brian and with Hugh, and, you know, Ian, it's unbearable hubris to just, I'll just toss off the first names. Like, on the other hand, I do know them.
Yeah.
You know, we have met. We have talked. It is the coolest thing since sliced bread. And, you know, that's certainly a whole lot of fun in and of itself. And the fact is that the reality is, without the work that Dave and John and I did, the story, and Frank, the stories wouldn't be here for them to adapt, and they wouldn't be here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you take what you can get and be proud and happy of that, as I think we should. And my only regret is that Dave isn't here to enjoy it more, as he should, you know, and that I'm not sure if John's here. I don't know how much he enjoys it, but he should, because this is as much his triumph as anyone else's.
Let me ask you one more thing. We'll let you go. We had that little bit of time before we started recording, mentioning a little bit about my experience with Will Eisner in the last couple of years of his life.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that struck me about him at the time and subsequently is that I think he took great comfort in knowing that during his lifetime he was respected for what he did. He was recognized and respected. And from what you just told me about how you feel about the movies and your excitement from seeing these characters and saying your lines, I get the sense that the answer that I'm going to get here is that you feel similarly, that you have been respected and recognized for your work during your career. Is that true, or am I overstating it?
I think this is where my being a former actor enters into the equation. I could sit there next to a stack of praise the height of the Chrysler Building and five notices that say and the praise would be irrelevant. The thing with any of us is that we look at the people who come in and say, you've done great work, and you nod to yourself and you think, okay, that was then, this is now. What do you think of what I'm doing today? What do you think of what I'll do tomorrow? Doing great work is easy because it's done. The unfinished stuff that's around the corner is the challenge, is the goad that pulls us on. I look on the X-Men, it was a lot of fun, but that's 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I look on, you know, Murata, and what I want to see is, can it lead to the next story? Can it lead to John and I coming together again and perhaps striking more fire and telling a story where just the two of us sitting there and drawing pictures, we can bring ancient Rome to life. We can create characters and conflicts that have relevance to a modern audience, that we can leave the people reading the story, ideally in a serial format, wanting to come back to see what happens next. If that's the result, then I'll be happy, because it means I'm doing my job, John's doing his job, and the end result is something that is creatively satisfying to us and emotionally satisfying to our readers. And you know, that's, to me, that's what it's all about. Not what I've done, which I'm incredibly proud of, but what I hope to do today, and what I hope to do tomorrow, because that'll prove that I can build off of what was before, that I've learned what has come before, that I can reach out and entice readers as much as I ever did, if not more so. And that, you know, I think that's why, that's what brings us all to sit down in front of the typewriter and start tapping away.
All right. Well, folks, you can find writer Chris Claremont and artist John Bolton's collected work so far on Murata, the She-Wolf, in a beautiful hardcover edition from Titan Books. It's in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching the video on Mr. Media, just below the video screen, you'll see the cover of the book. You can click on it right now, take it to Amazon. You can have it within a day or two in your very own hands. Chris, what's your web presence? Do you have a website? Do you do Twitter, Facebook, any of that kind of stuff?
A website, ChrisClaremont.com.
All right. Are you on Facebook?
I hang out on occasion on Facebook.
All right. Very good. Well, folks, you don't know this, but Chris does. He's been incredibly patient with us today. We've had some technical issues to get started. Absolutely a joy to talk to. A wonderful conversation. And Chris, thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today, and continued good writing and good luck.
Oh, pleasure was mine. Hope you like what the stuff that comes next.
Thank you very much.
You're more than welcome.
You can see and hear almost 1,000 Mr. Media interviews by visiting our main site, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Or check out the more than 200 video interviews on the Mr. Media radio site on YouTube. And I'd sure appreciate if you'd show some love for Mr. Media's advertisers, including Stitcher. Apple named Stitcher a top 5 news app of 2011. It's a free mobile app for your smartphone or tablet that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. You can listen whenever you want to more than 5,000 shows, get customized recommendations, and discover what your friends are listening to. My own list of Stitcher favorites is pretty eclectic. I start my day with an hour of MSNBC's Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Then it's the latest 2-minute update from the Onion News Network. After that, I'll listen to WTF with Mark Maron, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and excerpts from E's Chelsea Lately and The Soup with Joel McHale. Also in regular rotation on my Stitcher playlist, The BS Report with ESPN's Bill Simmons, The TechCrunch Headlines, and The Don Geronimo Show. The latest episodes of each show, whether originating from broadcasts, cable TV, radio syndication, or podcasts, are continuously updated. Stitcher is a free app for your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, Fire, BlackBerry, Droid, and more. And show your support of Mr. Media by getting, did I mention it's free? The app at stitcher.com/Mr. Media. That's stitcher.com/MR Media. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also supported by Audible. Check out Audible's 30-day trial membership and download the audiobook version of the book everyone's been talking about, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Sign up for your free trial today at audible.com/radio. Again, audibletrial.com/radio. And finally, if you need a disc jockey for a wedding, bar mitzvah, corporate event, or just a big old party, please consider calling 1-800-DIAL-DJS, the party authority for all your party entertainment needs. You can call 1-800-DIAL-DJS or go to their website, 1-800-DIAL-DJS.com, and tell them Mr. Media sent you. And thanks for listening. Some poor bastard has called you back and said, oh, by the way, it didn't record. Can we do it over again? I don't want to be that guy.
Well, when I had my one conceptual meeting with George Lucas to put together the novels I did of the Dragon Moon novels, we were an hour into the discussion before it finally dawned on me that the microphone wasn't plugged in.
I hate that. I so hate that.
He laughed. Not altogether humorously.